Good morning and welcome to our podcast. Today I have Dr. Mari with me and we are going to talk about unavailable people. So Dr. Mari, welcome.
Hello.
Hello. And you and I have been having a conversation, an ongoing conversation about unavailable people because a lot of our clients talk to us about being in a relationship with someone that is emotionally unavailable. And the way that I address this is I really believe that people are a mirror of us. So in some way or another, I think that we are also unavailable or there's something that's blocking us. But you came up with something the other day that really fascinated me and it really prompted us to do this podcast. You were telling me a story about someone who had a very early sexual experience. I think 9 years old is what you told me.
Yes.
And this person is very, very unavailable and keeps themselves pretty locked down emotionally and guarded. I mean, although they participate in life and they're very functional and have a great career, in their relationships, they're very guarded. And so I want you to talk a little bit about what happens when we have a sexual experience when we're too young to understand it mentally, biologically, physically, and how we can download that information. And it isn't just sexual. It can be anything that is hard for us to be able to understand and process. So give us a little bit of information about that because I find it so fascinating. I think it'll help people understand what it's like and why we become unavailable in relationships.
Okay, so it's complicated, but it's simple, if that makes sense. So, when we're developing, our brain is making connections to our experiences, right? And so generally, if development happens the way it's supposed to, you have a frame of reference for whatever experience you just had. So for instance, a baby will eat, right? That's like one of the first things a baby does is eats. And so when the baby says, I get joy from eating, there's a connection because eating is a developmental thing that they've already done, right? So if they have a good tasting food, the baby will jump up and down and hum and sing and all these fun stuff because they associate this joy with this food. Does that make sense?
Totally.
So when we have an experience in which we are not developmentally ready for, our brain still makes a connection to some experience that we already had. Something. It has to connect to something. So it's like a thought. A thought's never neutral. It's either positive or negative. It goes into the positive category or the negative category. Same thing happens when we have an experience that's beyond our development. It goes somewhere and it connects to something. And so what it connects to is something we already know. So, for instance, eating disorders a lot of times have a connection to sexual abuse. Why is that? Well, early sexual abuse leads to some eating disorders. Why is that? It's because the brain says, this feels good, but I don't like it. I'm not really sure what to do with it. So I'm going to connect it to food because I know food and food makes me feel good. So the good part of that connects to the food part. But then the other part connects to, I don't know. I don't know what this is. And the brain's like scrambling around trying to figure out a connection, right? And so a lot of times that connection kind of just is left waiting for an experience to make the connection to. Okay.
Is there ever a time when someone does not make a connection? Can that happen?
No. It makes a connection to something. Even if it's connecting to a feeling of fear. So then the fear, feeling, and that are connected. So it connects something in that brain.
So that's really interesting. So then some people I find that are unavailable, let's just say that they didn't have something sexual happen to them. Mm-hmm. But what if their mother or father rejected them when they were really young? And they would say things like, you know what? You're worthless. I wish you were never born. And things like that. Wouldn't they also have, and then the mother or father goes back to them and says, I'm really sorry, I love you. That creates a really interesting dynamic later in life because, the abuse felt really badly. They beat themselves up. And then the person came back and they said, I'm really sorry, I love you. And you see what I'm saying? And that creates a habit and a pattern too, doesn't it?
Right. Right. So okay. Think about this connection, right? So like I said, this is hard but simple. So a baby experiences loneliness when mom leaves the room, right? Or if they wake up in a crib and no one's there, right? So they're like, there's a little bit of fear, there's a little bit of anxiety, there's a little bit of all these things that happen that are kind of, we call negatives, not necessarily negative, but we call negative emotion. The baby cries, mom comes, right?
Right, right.
So baby has both experiences, this negative experience and this positive experience. So when a mom or a dad says, you're worthless, the baby has a place to connect it to. The feeling that I felt when I was alone in the crib, mm-hmm. by myself, and I was scared and I didn't know what to do, so I cried for my mom, you know?
Oh, that's really interesting, because that goes into a feeling of loneliness and isolation, which could indicate why some people can't stand to be alone.
Exactly. So,
but it can also work the opposite, couldn't it? Where people push people away
absolutely.
So that they can be alone. Oh, that's really
absolutely.
Fascinating.
So that's right? why I say, so unavailable people, a lot of times there's this earlier childhood experience, generally, now this is a general statement, that forms this thought pattern around that particular feeling, that particular experience. And even when they become big adults, 50, 60, 100 years old, they still revert back to that as how they handle that situation. When they feel that, when they experience that.
Okay. So this makes a lot of sense to me. And so I want to go through something really quickly, my thought process, and then I want to have you, because I want everybody to understand this. So we know that when we are in utero, when our mother is pregnant with us, that we're in a state called the delta state, and that's like the sleep state. And after we're born, we're in the delta state. So basically from 0 to 2, we're in delta.
Okay.
And so we're taking everything in. So as your mother is holding you and feeding you and gazing lovingly at you and all of those things, right, that you are transferring information to your child, right? Okay. And so that's a love. And the mother can also be very upset, and she can be angry feeding the child, and the child feeds that, which is a really interesting association, because on the one hand, let's just say she's either breastfeeding, maybe she's bottle feeding, mm-hmm. and the child is getting fed. But the child is also feeling this energy, right? And the energy is, you know, I'm stressed. I don't like this. I hate my husband, or whatever is going on. I'm worried about money. So the child takes on, I would say, because feeding, like you said, this feels good, right?
Right.
But then the energy is, but something's not right here with mom. And the child doesn't download that information like that. The child just feels. The child takes
right.
it in. Then from 2 to 7, we are in a state called the theta state. And the theta state is still a subconscious state, which means under consciousness, which is why it's so hard for us to remember what was happening, because we took things in on a subconscious level, everything. And so after the age, so usually abuse begins, I think, what do they say? Is it between 0 and 9? When a sexual, now it can happen afterward. You can be molested by somebody outside the family in school, right? Or something like that. Okay. And a violation is a violation. And it doesn't really, but what I notice is when it is subconscious, we find that people are repeating the same habits, the same patterns, the same thoughts ad infinitum and ad nauseum.
Right.
And they get so frustrated, and they say to me, I've got to go back to the drawing board. I've got to remember what happened. And my question to you is, do they need to remember what happened? And what happens if they can't remember what happened?
No, I don't. I mean, sometimes it is important. I mean, so it is a case-by-case basis, but generally it's not. What's important is the feeling and the behavior, the resulting behavior. So mm-hmm. if I have a feeling of worthlessness because mm-hmm. my boyfriend says he doesn't want to go to the movies with me tonight, right? Mm-hmm. That's a pretty mm-hmm. exaggerated response to that experience. So generally that tells me there's something that's really internal hidden away from this person, right? Mm-hmm. That doesn't connect. So I don't need to know exactly what happened. What I need to know is this response cycle. And then I can fix the response cycle to this
event. So let's go through this for a second. So I agree with you. Anytime we create a feeling, the subconscious mind says, okay, And it will absolutely build a bridge of consciousness to let that happen. Now, typically our neural networks are already in place. So anytime we're triggered, like my boyfriend, you say, I want to go see a movie tonight. And he goes, I don't feel like seeing a movie. And you go crazy. And you start feeling all of these feelings. And he's looking at you like you're crazy.
Right.
You know, all I said was, I didn't want to go to the movies tonight. I want to relax. Well, you don't care about me. And you, right. And we go into our thing. And that's when we become the hamster on the wheel.
Right.
And what happens a lot of times is people can't stop themselves and they don't want to stop themselves because that feels right. And it is comfortably uncomfortable. And they continually ruin their relationships, and they actually begin to feed off of the cycle, and they repeat things like, this always happens to me, story of my life, why do women always leave me, why do I always wind up with men or women like this? And it is because they have a hard time recognizing what they are feeling. So how does someone become, I use meditation, but I want to know through you, what is another process to help people and teach people to become aware of the feeling? Like, there's got to be a starting point, because usually they launch without even knowing. They just launch right into it without even knowing. So what would you say prescribe, right? And we're going to use something, you know, across the board. So like you said, it's a case by case basis. And I absolutely agree that everybody's individual, but what would you do, or what would you tell somebody that is saying, I have a hard time stopping myself. I keep doing this.
So one is that usually, like we were talking about, there's some subconscious unawareness. That's not the word I'm looking for, but they're just not aware of what's that real response cycle is. They have really no idea where this comes from. They're in response mode all the time. They're not really thinking things through. So what I start with is something's really benign, and I ask them to just write their autobiography. Right. And not like get a piece of paper out and just type up for the last 25 years of your life, but just like, okay, our first memory is usually around kindergarten. That's when we can have a really fixed memory, because we have landmarks that help us understand where we are and what we were doing. So I say, okay, just go through every year of your elementary school years, then go to middle school, then go to high school, and just tell me, where did you live? Who was your friends? What occurred for you? What was your experience, basically? I'm trying to figure out what this experience is. And a lot of time, they'll get to, you know, whatever the age is, because it's all different for everybody, right? They'll get to that age where they're like, you know what? My dad called me a such and such when I was 11, when I was getting ready to go to school that day. And they just kind of vomit out this stuff. And I was like, okay, that helps me understand that somewhere around there is where you started thinking about things a little differently, or life became different for you from what you knew, what you didn't know, whatever. Mm-hmm. So this kind of process of self-discovery by just writing your story starts to help you start thinking about where you came from and what happened to you while you were developing. Does that make sense?
It totally makes sense. And also paying attention to what's happening in your body while you're describing it, because your shoulders can go up, you can get really tight, you stop breathing. And I don't mean you stop breathing, but you stop breathing as you would naturally. And you can also come to find that you aren't breathing naturally because you're always uptight.
Right.
And when you're always in a state of tension, your cells are constantly listening. And this is part of how people make themselves sick.
Right.
Now this is a really hard nut to swallow, I think, for people, because they say, I'm not creating this. This is actually happening outside of me.
But
it's happening outside of them because they're creating it based on their perception.
Right. Exactly.
Because when you can change your perception. And this is where, you know, and I don't mean rote affirmation where you just say, I'm having a good day, I'm having a good day, I'm having, that can work, but you have to stop yourself and you have to want to have a good day. You have to have the desire.
Right.
You have to have that feeling. And then you can say, you know what? I'm sorry, what?
And sometimes even analyzing why it wasn't a good day, right? Like, so a lot
That's
of
a great practice.
People will
great
get into
practice.
This. I have to be positive. I cannot be negative. I can't. And it's like, whoa, thinking about what happened wrong is not negative. Actually, it's positive because you now have the power to change that thing. You know, if that makes sense. So sometimes we get into, especially in this pop psychology stuff, where we're just supposed to be happy all the time and nothing bad is supposed to ever happen. And if we even let anything bad in, we're going to be, you know, it's going to destroy this rhythm we have. And it's like, no.
Yeah, we're lame. We failed. Yeah, that's not true at all.
Not true at all. Right.
I have a practice that I have my clients do. And I tell them, when you get into bed at night, the best time to do this, because you're falling asleep, you're more relaxed, right? It also helps turn off your mind.
Right.
Go through your day backward. Start from getting into bed and go through your day backward. And when you run into a situation where you think, God, I should have never spoken to my boss like that, stop, rewind, and create it the way you want to. The things that you would have said, and then go all the way back to when you woke up. And when you fall asleep in that state, your subconscious mind is taking that in. You're creating new neural networks based on a feeling, because you know you didn't want to do that. And I don't really call them bad or good. They're just events that we create.
Exactly.
Because we have a tendency to beat ourselves up when we're like, oh God, you know, I mean, how many times have you just been ashamed or mortified when you've made a mistake, right? And that shame and that mortification that you feel really is, again, in a subconscious state that you don't even recognize. And all of a sudden, it'll ruin your whole day.
Right.
You know, that's when you know, all you can think about is, I got to get to the bar, you know, when I'm done with work. And this is why people, you know, begin to drink, because they're trying to kill that pain.
Right.
And so what I like is, what I like to see, and I know what you like to see, is in order for us to heal those parts of ourselves that are shattered and broken because of things that people said to us and experiences that we had when we were young and we were these little sponges that took everything in. So a lot of these experiences are ours, but they were fed to us based on what our primary caregivers were giving to us, what they were experiencing.
Right.
And some of them are ours, but they aren't ours, and they can be changed.
Right.
And so I want to talk a little bit about being in a relationship with someone that is emotionally unavailable.
Right.
And I want you to talk a little bit about, I think this, there's a guy on YouTube, and I'm sure a lot of people listen to him. He's a dating coach. His name is Matthew Hussey. And I think that Matthew Hussey has a lot of really great insight into, for women, handling men. Because a lot of times women are coming from a place of, I want, I need, and they're grasping and they're pushing. And I have found with emotionally unavailable people, you don't want to use the front door. You want to use a side door or the back door.
Right.
Because these people are protecting themselves from feeling something that has been scary to them.
Right.
Love hasn't necessarily been the way, and this goes for women too, especially if there's been sexual abuse, either male or female, right? These people have a tendency to be, sometimes they can be overly needy.
Mm-hmm.
And want, and that's why you're going in the front door and you're like, I'm going to smother you. I'm going to put myself all over you because I need this. And the other person is saying, my God, get away from me. I can't handle this.
Right.
But the people that become very emotionally unavailable, they find ways to avoid.
Right.
And so when you're talking to somebody that is dealing with an emotionally unavailable person, what is the first thing that you tell them?
Wow. That's a good question. The first thing, you know, it's not personal. I mean, that's like the first thing we talk about is that
that's good.
This person's doing this because this is what this person does. And they do it to everyone. It's just that you're the one that's experiencing it right now. So let's not internalize this behavior. Now, of course, you know, there's limits to everything and you have to decide whether you want to walk through this with someone. And I don't want anybody to become anyone else's therapist, but it is trying to figure out, is this related to this person just doesn't want a relationship and they don't know how to say that, or this person doesn't know how to do a relationship. So it's the first one. Well, you kind of got to run, you know, if you don't want it and you're going to push something that's never going to happen. If it's the other one, it is, you know, giving the person space and opportunity to help them understand their own behaviors while you kind of call them out on that stuff. Right. So you say you don't want, or you say you want me close, but when I call, you don't answer. You know, it's like, help me understand that. And it's not that they don't want a relationship. They just don't know how to do a relationship. So again, it's not personalizing what they do. And then it's determining what, from what position is this person coming from. And if it's the second thing, if it's the, I don't know how, then it's giving the person space, but yet still stating needs and wants. And then hopefully that person gets some help, because that, you know, you can't fix them. That's, you can't fix them. You can understand them, but you can't fix it.
That's, you know what, you just took the words right out of my mouth. When people come to me and they are explaining what they're dealing with somebody, and you know that there is a relationship there, and the other person that's calling, right, our client, is not getting what they want or need, the very first thing I say is, you have to understand the person you're dealing with. If you can't understand the person you're dealing with and you are trying to shove down their throat what you want and the way you want it, you'll kill the relationship.
Right.
You have to understand that that person needs, what I find with people who are emotionally unavailable is they desperately want to be loved. And they need to be nurtured, and they need to be understood, and they need to have their space. And so it's really, sometimes people, women become very afraid when a man will sometimes say, you know, I just need space right now. And I have found that when people say, totally understand, you got it, that it actually creates a stronger relationship, because you are understanding that that person needs space instead of reacting from a place of, oh my God, does this mean he wants to break up with me? Is there somebody else? Is there something I should be worried about? Did I do something wrong? Right. And you go into your litany of your own subconscious fear.
Yeah.
It's sometimes really hard when you're in a relationship with an emotionally unavailable person to put a lid on your own stuff.
Right.
And you will push and you will go crazy and you will change the energy, because everything is energy. Everything is communicated all the time. And I've learned that in my own life. I had a client say to me just yesterday, you know, Jocelyn, you taught me something that if I chase it away. And I thought, yeah, the reason I could teach you that is because that's what I learned.
Right.
If you chase it, a lot of times you're going to chase it away.
Absolutely.
And so we need to also remember that relationships are a mirror. And although we may not have been sexually molested or abused, if, you know, we have had experiences that are buried so deeply in our subconscious minds that we can also be very unavailable.
Right.
And not know it. And right. Be trying to fill a void. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. And do you find that in your practice too?
Yeah, that, I think that's what started our conversation, you know, a couple of weeks ago about this, was that, you know, the person I was talking to was a male, and he was a machismo male, you know, kind of had that macho thing going on. And, you know, when he was telling me, just in a candid conversation, very openly, that he had his first, you know, he was a ladies' man. That's basically what he said to me. And he said, and I had my first sexual experience when I was 9. I paused and I just looked at him like, did you hear what you just said? And he looked at me like,
is that like possible at 9?
No, it's not. So I was like, wait, he's very disconnected from what really happened to him. What the actual reality.
So explain that. What actually did happen then?
So a nine-year-old can't process sex, right? They're developmentally, they're not ready for that. You know, sex hormones happen around puberty. That's why we have quote unquote the horny teenager, right? It's because they have sex hormones and all this other stuff. So prior to that, there aren't any, which means that that had to have been a sexual abusive relationship, even if he wasn't, it wasn't painful and it wasn't seemingly hurtful and these things like that. Because
how come you determine it like that though? How do you know it's abusive?
Well, you can't consent at 9. You know, you don't have the ability to make sense of sex at nine. So
if
someone
was with another 9 year old, or what if it was with a 12 year old, somebody that was being sexually abused?
It doesn't matter. I mean, again, I'm not saying the person who did this is a perpetrator like we think of in the movies. Generally, this person was abused too, and so they're confused as well. If they're trying to have sex with at nine or 12, a 9 year old, they're confused as well. So they're two confused people doing this, right? Because they don't have what's necessary to be able to participate in this type of thing.
So let's do a scenario, because I like scenarios, because I like to really get into detail so I can understand it. So let's say that the person that you were speaking to, who's a machismo male, okay, 9 years old. Mm-hmm. Let's just say that this was happening with a 12-year-old girl.
Okay.
And let's say that the 12-year-old girl, obviously she wouldn't just all of a sudden want to be sexual, is what you're saying. Am I right?
Correct.
With a 9-year-old boy. Was being abused by somebody or had a sexual experience, whether it be brother, uncle, father, whatever it is, even mother. Okay. So she then, is it, I mean, does she, what's happening for her that she says, okay, I want to do this with you? What's happening there?
So, I mean, again,
The next question is, why would he respond other than it feels good? But go ahead.
Well, that's part of, I mean, there's all kinds of reasons. It could be peer pressure. It could be there could have been some grooming him, right? Because this child knows how to groom, because this child was groomed as well.
Right? She was groomed, the girl?
Yeah, she was groomed. Uh-huh. So then she starts grooming. So basically she's just repeating, she's parroting what happened and acting it out with someone else. So, and I'll just make this statement. Generally, again, I'm very careful about this. Generally, someone who's been abused sexually at a young age, I'm not talking about someone who can make sense of the sexual abuse, even if it's wrong, it still makes sense. Mm-hmm. Like someone 16, it's awful, it's horrible, no one ever should be abused that way. But a 16-year-old can say, I understand what sex is. You know what I'm saying? And you simply violated me, and I don't like the violation. A 9-year-old doesn't even know they're violated sometimes. They don't even know what's supposed to happen. So anyway, so she's parroting what she learned from someone else. Now, why does he, quote unquote, allow it to happen? Because he might have been groomed as well. He's curious. All 9-year-olds are curious. You know, they're curious people, right?
And it feels good. And it feels good.
Right? Mm-hmm. It's abusive. You know what I'm saying?
And I'm trying to, I'm thinking, you know, from a 9-year-old's place is, you know, something like this is happening. If you're being groomed,
right,
you're being seduced. Basically. That's grooming is seducing.
Right.
And so this child is being seduced in their mind and this feels good and there's warmth involved. And then and from the heart, warmth from the heart, right? Feeling and a connection with this person. And so if they then touch you in a sexual way, it feels good.
Right.
And the most fascinating part for me is how somebody attaches that, because I know that women think this is sex is love. Sex feels good. This person, a lot of times, yeah, generally, right? Mm-hmm. I don't want to say all the time. And so she will then put that into motion in her subconscious mind again, because we're talking about feeling.
Right.
And then she begins to act that out. But here's the interesting part. Why the unavailability from the man?
Well, so again, when we're making connections to things, right? So we're talking about this one particular case. This is how this happened for him. He was groomed to believe, before anything ever happened, that this was being a man. This was being cool. This was being one of the guys. He was groomed to believe this. So when the
happens with boys,
So that's emotionally abusive already, right? That you're at 9 years old.
You mean that guy thing when guys are like, this is awesome. I mean, if you can get a girl sexually.
Yeah.
Right?
At nine. And we're not talking about 16-year-olds that are horny teenagers. Okay. They're talking about sex because they're thinking about it every single day, all day long, because their sex hormones are in full gear. That makes sense. For a 9-year-old, that's not occurring. Right. So somebody's giving this information in a time and a place that they're not ready for it.
So they're in, we're still in such a creative state at the age of 9. Yeah, right. You're right.
We're still trying to make sense of what this person is saying in his brain. Now he's going to perform. He's going to parrot what the person's told him to do. But his brain is trying to say, okay, what is this thing called sex? Okay, it's a tough guy thing. It's not intimate. It's not emotional. It's a tough guy thing at 9. So I'm just going to be a tough guy. I'm going to be a superhero type of guy. That's what the 9-year-old connects
interesting.
To.
Interesting. Mm-hmm.
Right? So with this gentleman, in his life, that's how he performs with women. It's like a superhero. He's like the Clark Kent. He's going to come in. He's going to rescue a woman. He's going to have sex with her, and he's going to fly out. Because the intimacy part never occurred because he wasn't even in a position where he could understand that that's a part of it. When a 16-year-old has sex with another 16-year-old that they're both in, you know, consenting and all that fun stuff, even though we don't want 16-year-olds to have sex, but still.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
The guy and the girl both at that moment think they're in love. You see what I'm saying? It's like, oh, I love her. Oh, I love him. Oh, my gosh. Right?
Yeah. Yes, 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 yes.
And then the sex may happen and then he might be like, oh, well, that was great. Now I'm going to find another girl. But that's normal, right? Because we got into this sexual relationship because we have this feeling of, I want to be with this person and she's my girlfriend and he's my boyfriend. There's intimacy in there. There's relationship in there. A 9-year-old can't make sense of that. A 9-year-old can like another girl. Can like a girl, right? But he's not thinking about having sex with her.
So that's a lot of reason why guys will do one and done, right? They'll, you know, blow and go basically, right?
Right.
Because they haven't had the connection of the intimacy, which, by the way, goes all the way back to mom too.
Right.
And sometimes men are they can be overly loving and, you know, their hearts can be really open with a woman because they want to attach to that warm feeling of love, right?
Right.
And so that's really interesting.
It's unbalanced, right? So again, it's hard, but it's easy to understand. It's hard because you're like, okay, well, isn't that part of the normal way of life? Yes, but abuse comes in when it's developmentally not ready. It's developmentally not in time from a sex abuse position. And we're talking about young kids. Now, again, when somebody is raped or something like that, that's something very different than what we're talking about here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when it's subconscious, usually it's early. It's early. Mm-hmm. It's so early that you don't have all the connections ready. You don't have the doors open yet to those type of experiences.
So wouldn't that also be a child that is abused or talked to in a way that is negative? Those, you know, are hit, right? Or beaten. Those are also, you know, reasons, I think, for people to, you know, obviously become perpetrators in that way. But also to be very emotionally unavailable because they think to themselves, I'm worthless, you know, or I'm bad.
It can definitely be that. Now, what we do see is that sex abuse in early adolescence is more profound than any other type of abuse. And that's because, again, the sex door, the door that you go through is opened in puberty. So there's no door. So they have to connect to something that is not that. It's not about emotional and romance and all that fun stuff. It's got to be about something else. And so they connect to something else, and it's very distorted because that's not the right connection.
So women, I find, and maybe this is just because we are more emotional, typically sometimes when they're abused, they can be like men. You know, they can have multiple partners and just, you know, move on. But I find many of them are looking for love. I mean, really looking for love. And there is a need and a dependency. And I agree with you a lot. This is where you see anorexia, bulimia, overeating, drinking, and drugs. Because they're trying to kill a pain because they don't know where to put that.
Right.
You know, they know that it's wrong. Societally, they've been told it was wrong. And yet, a lot of times, the very person that is their caretaker is the one that's doing it to them.
Right.
And so I can understand now when this happens, they can't download that information and they can become, many people can operate and, you know, they can be angry, they can get married and have children and get to a certain point. but this, it will torment them, and it can torment them. It's right. Interesting, but it isn't Absolutely. Always an unavailable person isn't always sexually abused.
No, not at all. Not at all. Again, this is just, we're just talking about this particular topic. Again, that's why we don't try to fix someone who's in our life that exhibits some of these things, because we have no idea what really is the deal. Our job is to, you know, kind of point out that they're reacting in a way that doesn't make sense, you know, and to encourage them to go figure out why that is. You know, so you kind of love them to health that way, but you don't try to figure out, oh, is this person sexually abused? Is that what's going on? No, that's not what we're looking to do.
Okay. You're right. I got it. You don't want to diagnose them. You right. just need to understand that you don't want to come in the front door.
No.
You have to understand the person.
Absolutely.
Right? And that takes time by talking to them and understanding their rhythm.
Right.
Right. Because a lot of times
calling out that inconsistency, you know, because again, generally when someone has something that they're not aware of, because that's what we're really talking about, this subconscious response cycle. Mm-hmm. They're not really aware that they're doing it. They know they do it. They have no idea why, and they can't make it all make sense. Mm-hmm. That there is something deeper there. Now, what that something is, nobody knows, right? Mm-hmm. We don't know until they go and figure that stuff out. And so, yes, our job is to love them through it, or until we can't handle it anymore, that type of thing. But not to beat them up or, you know, call them out every single time something happens, or to be all over them, because that just makes them act more of whatever that is, because they don't know that response cycle as is.
Right. They run farther away.
Right.
If you keep calling them out, it is about understanding them. And it's also about controlling our own selves.
Exactly.
Right. You have to understand that a lot of times you do have to leave if you don't feel like you're getting what you want. But if you're chasing, there's the chase again. If you're chasing this person to get your needs met, you're going to be disappointed.
Absolutely.
You have to be able to sit still and love that person, no matter what they're doing.
Right.
You have to love them.
It's like a mirror. So if you're doing that chase, then maybe there's some unspoken, unknown response cycle for you too. Right? That you have to figure out. And again, it doesn't have to be deep, dark sexual abuse. It's just something.
Mm-hmm. You know, I've always said to people, if you give me enough time with you, I can show you the mirror.
Right.
Because they usually call and they say, there's no way this can be a mirror of me. But it is.
Right.
You know, in one way or another, behaviorally and mentally.
Right.
You know, you are, like attracts like.
Right.
It happens. Exactly. And so when we spend enough time looking at that, they can start to put together the puzzle. And when they change themselves, the other person changes. Everything on the outside changes because your perception changes.
Right.
And that's a lot of times when we can actually make these relationships work, is first in understanding self, right? But you, a lot of times, are understanding self through the very thing that you've attracted to yourself and created.
Right.
The other person.
Right.
You know, so it can be very enlightening. Instead of going, you know, relationship after relationship, but of course, I don't mean stay in an abusive relationship, but take a step back,
right,
and begin to do some inner work as to why. It's a really interesting conversation and concept. So, anyway,
yeah,
this has been great. Thank you. I'm really glad we did this podcast, because I think it will really help people understand. You know, a lot of times emotionally unavailable people have had experiences that they can't get down to and they can't understand. And so loving them is understanding them.
Right.
And also when you understand them, you're actually understanding self.
Right. Exactly.
I think that's really, really cool. Do you have anything else to add before we wrap this up?
Yeah. You know, I guess just, you know, to pull it all together is that not everybody was sexually abused. So that's not the issue. But if someone was at a very early age, it might explain some of their distance without knowing they're distant, some of their inconsistencies, because they really just made connections that they don't even know they made. And then our job is to point out when there's inconsistencies, decide if we're able to handle that, and then help somebody get to care.
Right. And understand. Right. Thank you for joining us and listening today. I am really grateful for Dr. Mari and her insight, and I hope that we helped you understanding a little bit more about yourself and unavailable people in relationships.